This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Radio is proud to help Zippity News and a clothes drive to help clothe the homeless. We will be collecting gloves, hats, and scarves until February 15th, when the clothes will be distributed throughout the homeless community. KBOO is located on 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, just off Burnside. Thank you, and we hope to see you donating clothes to help keep the homeless warm this winter.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Tonight we're going to talk about prison reform. Governor Kitzhaber formed a public safety commission with a directive to analyze Oregon's sentencing and corrections policies and submit recommendations. The commission has been meeting for 2 years, and in December 2012, they'd submitted their report to Governor Kitzhaber, which is now before the Oregon legislature. With me are Shannon White from Partnership for Safety and Justice and Karen Muir from Phoenix Rising Transitions. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Shannon, let's start with the commission. Now, they have been meeting for 2 years. Both you and Karen attended the public hearings. Who is on the commission?
It was a bipartisan commission made up of 4 legislators, 2 Republican and 2 Democrat, one from each chamber, the House and the Senate, and then a number of public safety stakeholders, including the district attorneys, community corrections, the criminal defense lawyers, a judge, the former Supreme Court Justice Paul DeMuna. So it was a wide range of folks who were on that commission.
And what was your overall impression of the commission?
I think the commission was a very fair and thoughtful group of folks who brought their perspectives to the table. As I'm sure we'll discuss later, the District Attorneys Association was opposed to the work of the commission from the beginning and basically stayed opposed. But everyone else really engaged very thoughtfully. They were given a lot of data and came up with, I think, a strong set of recommendations based on data to help move Oregon forward with our public safety system.
And Karen, what was your overall impression of the commission?
I thought the commission was very thorough. They did take 2 years to hear from almost all stakeholders involved, which I think was very impressive. And I think that for me, what is really important is the emphasis on transitional services. And that's near and dear to my heart because that's what my organization does. So I was glad to see that was included.
And what was the directive from Governor Kitzhaber?
The directive from the governor was to flatline our prison growth and make sure that we were defining our public safety policies with best practices, evidence-based practices, so that we could ensure we were using the most efficient and effective policies within our public safety system, something that he's wanted to do in our other education and healthcare as well.
And why reform? Why now?
Why now? Because the budget is calling for it. Our corrections budget has increased dramatically over the last almost 2 decades, and is in taking up an increasingly large part of our general fund budget. And while classrooms are being cut, services for people are being cut, our prison system has continued to expand. And I think a lot of folks have come together, the governor and others, to say, are we being as effective as we can be with this system? Because we need to be to make sure we're using every dollar wisely, given the tight budget times we have right now.
And how is this researched?
The research was analyzed by the Pew Center on the States, has a public safety performance project that has worked in a number of states around the country to help states find efficiencies in their system. They came to Oregon and worked with our Criminal Justice Commission and Department of Corrections to analyze Oregon's data. We have great data systems compared to many other states here. And they did the analysis and presented it to the commissioners at a series of meetings over the last several months.
The report says that in the next 10 years, Oregon will need $600 million for construction of new prisons and operations. We'll need 2,300 more beds for yet more prisoners. Talk about that.
It's been identified by Pew and our own Department of Corrections that we are on track to need 2,300 more prison beds over the next decade at a cost of $600 million. The recommendations outlined by the commission take those prison beds offline so we can flatline prison growth, not have to build any more prisons over the next 10 years, not have to spend that $600 million. And I would just add to that, I think the way that Pew has done their work around the states, and they're doing it here in Oregon, is around this model called justice reinvestment. And that really means looking at how we save money, but also where we need to reinvest those dollars to keep a strong public safety system. So their recommendations include reentry programs, they include victim services, they include community corrections. So it's not just freeing up dollars in our correctional system and throwing them to the general fund wind, but actually making sure that we have a strong public safety system in all the areas where funding is needed.
So what were some of the other findings?
So Oregon's prison growth has increased dramatically over, they found, the last 10 years, but it's really been almost 20 years that we've been seeing this huge uptick of when we had about 6,000 beds in Oregon in 1995 to having over 14,000 beds in Oregon today. And they've found, Pew and the researchers also found that recently, while Oregon has been relatively good about mostly incarcerating people convicted of violent crimes, that trend has changed in the last few years, and we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of nonviolent people going to prison as well. And so part of this is changing that trajectory because we are, in fact, spending $1.4 billion per biennium on corrections. And it is the most expensive tool we have for holding people accountable. So part of this is really looking at where can we hold people accountable in the most efficient and effective way so that people, yes, are held accountable and are less likely to commit crime when they come home from prison or parole or whatever accountability they end up receiving.
So the Public Safety Commission presented the governor with 19 recommendations. Let's highlight some of the recommendations that the Oregon legislature will be addressing in this session.
Yeah, there are a number of recommendations in the report. There's also a section on how some of that money can be reinvested, as we mentioned earlier. And there also is a section on items that were considered but not move forward as recommendations. And I'll just say from Partnership for Safety and Justice perspective, those are all good ideas as well that weren't moved forward. But we do, while we are supportive of this report, we actually think it could have gone further with its recommendations and that these reforms are incredibly modest. I do want to say that this is not a Measure 11 reform package. This is not a package that would let anyone out of prison early. And still, it's on a trajectory to help Oregon not have to spend $600 million over the next 10 years. So it's a very modest package with a wonderful financial impact for the state, and I think can have us with a stronger public safety system than the one we have now. That said, I think, you know, the big cost drivers that were identified by the commission and Pew were around some of the sentencing practices that we currently have. As folks probably remember, a few years ago, Oregon voters passed Measure 57, which increased sentences for some drug and property crimes. And that's a big driver of now nonviolent people being sent to prison with a particular impact on women. And the other pieces, a big piece is small tweaks to some aspects of Measure 11 crimes that are currently subject to mandatory minimum sentences. I don't know how much detail you want to go into about those.
Actually, I find that people still don't understand the implications of Measure 11. So let's give a brief overview.
Sure. For folks who haven't heard of Measure 11, or maybe, as you said, there is some confusion about it, Measure 11 was passed, ballot Measure 11 was passed in 1994 by the voters, and it created a mandatory minimum sentences for 16 person crimes. The legislature has then added a handful of others, and those sentences are attached to the crime. So if you are convicted of an assault one, you have a certain set sentence, and that does not matter your age or your criminal history or any the circumstances of your crime, the judge is bound by the law passed by the voters to impose that sentence.
As young as 15 years old. And the mandatory sentences start at 5 years, 10 months.
That's right.
So any of these crimes, you are automatically going to prison for at least 6 years.
Right. That was a really significant part of Measure 11, is that it created an automatic transfer of youth who would have, before the measure passed, been held accountable within the juvenile justice system, are now automatically held accountable within the adult criminal justice system. And there is no discretion outside of the district attorney's charging decision about which youth get transferred. So we at Partnership for Safety and Justice certainly feel that was one of the harshest and most dramatically out of sync with what's best practices for youth, because youth who end up in the adult system, they end up in adult jails, they end up with an adult felony conviction. It's very hard for these youth to get back on track, and that should not be just a charging decision. That decision should be taken much more seriously and in front of a judge. So those youth, right, you could be a 15-year-old convicted of the assault one or a 35-year-old convicted of the assault one, and you're going to get the same sentence.
As far as the people that I've worked with in the prison, it does impact youth differently. And we've had one fellow who was 19 when he went in for a Measure 11 sentence. And he said that there was no incentive for him to do any kind of personal work or change because he knew he would be in for that amount of time anyway. Now, fortunately, in that case, he decided that he wanted to make change on his own, which was great. But I think that the state is losing some opportunities to get some real change going in young folks. And then in addition to that, people who are in Measure 11 sentences when they're young, they lose out on the entire experience that their peers are having, going to school, working, learning some of the maturation skills that they need to be able to function in the world. So they get out when they're 22, 23, 24, but they have the experience of a 15, 16, 17-year-old in navigating the systems of the outside world and the community. So that's something that's a real detriment to especially youth who are going in.
The commission's report says that research has shown that these longer sentences, they don't really stop additional crimes. And Clackamas County District Attorney Foote, who served on the commission, feels that Measure 11, these mandatory minimum sentencing laws, have contributed to the reduction in crime rates here in Oregon. But the Oregonian says that the researchers found that increases in police forces and improvements in their techniques, changes in drug markets, and the aging population in Oregon have contributed to a safer Oregon. Has Measure 11 really had that much of an impact in these past 20 years?
It certainly hasn't had the primary or the only impact. I mean, all I think criminologists will say that incarceration has some impact on crime, right? Because the person's incarcerated, right? So there is an impact. But there are many other things that are impact as well. And actually, as the crime rate's gone down, criminologists have become increasingly confused about what the real cause is, because some states that had mandatory minimums have seen decreases. Other states that didn't or lessened their sentences have also had decreases. So there are clearly a number of ways to do public safety right, and a lot of things that we don't know. They have, though, done research that is showing increasingly that a long sentence not only doesn't necessarily have the intended rehabilitative effect, but can start to have a negative impact on a person and make them more likely to commit a crime. And I know increasing research has been done to see at what point are we actually making it more likely that a person will commit a crime by having them incarcerated. I think actually a lot of even correctional workers here in Oregon know that prison is not the best place to become a well person and to come out and not commit future crime, and that is going to be your last choice. And we want to make sure, and I think this commission's working on this, to make sure that is the last choice. It's our most expensive and possibly least effective choice and should only be used in the rarest of circumstances.
So what does this public safety report say about Measure 11?
So the commission identified 3 out of the 21 Measure 11 charges to recommend some modest changes to, and those were assault 2, robbery 2, and sex abuse 1. Those are lower level offenses within Measure 11 and ones that include a large range of behavior. So it could be a more minor assault to a more serious assault, A robbery, too, could involve a very serious and scary incident, or it could be more like kids get in a fight and one steals a cell phone and that, you know, after the fight. And so those are the kinds of range of behavior that can happen. And we believe, and the commission, I think, believes are better suited to a judge being able to evaluate, is this one of those more serious cases where I want more serious accountability? Or is this a kid who made some really bad choices and we need to hold him accountable, but maybe not with, you know, a 70-month sentence, as you were referring to?
Yes. So right now, under Measure 11, they just go right to prison for almost 6 years for any degree of robbery, too. The commissioners are saying in this report, let's give the judge discretion and see what is best for this person for rehabilitation. And maybe 6-7 years is not the answer.
That's right. That's right. So just putting judges back in the sentencing process for those three crimes is their recommendation around Measure 11. And I do want to repeat, that would not apply to anyone currently in prison. And I know there are possibly a lot of listeners for whom they are hoping that that's part of the commission's recommendation. And they are explicit throughout the report that none of the recommendations would apply to people currently in prison.
And if you just tuned in, this is KBOO Portland. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm Karen James. And with me are Shannon White from Partnership for Safety and Justice and Karen Muir from Phoenix Rising Transitions. And we're talking about Governor Kitzhaber's Public Safety Commission and its recommendations for prison reform. So this proposed change to Measure 11, while it's very modest and sensible, will no doubt be controversial. So what other changes are the commission proposing?
One of the other recommendations that people might be interested in is one around increased earn time. Again, it would not apply to anyone currently in prison, but there is a recommendation around increasing people who currently are eligible for 20% earn time and increasing that to 30%. And of course, earn time is when people who are in prison are engaging in their treatment program, following the rules, that they can earn time off of their sentence and be transitioned into the community sooner than their later release date. It's an incentive-based sort of program, and one I think that mostly correctional officers support because they actually like when people are incarcerated having an incentive to do well and to work hard at their programming.
I think there's one little piece of information that goes along with that that I think is misunderstood oftentimes. People refer to high-risk criminals and prisoners, and I think that when people hear that, they often think violent, that means high risk is high risk of committing a violent crime. Actually, high risk means that there's a likelihood that they'll return to prison. So it could be a relatively nonviolent crime, but they can still be at high risk for keeping to come in and out of the system.
So I would just want to mention that one of the issues that's come up is that Oregon's cost per inmate per day is higher than some states. That's been put out there a lot in the media. The truth is we're at just slightly above the national average. And I just want to mention that a state that I lived and worked in for 15 years, Louisiana, has the lowest cost per inmate per day. I can tell you that our recidivism rate is high, our violent crime rate is high. We do not want to underpay correctional staff who are working in very tense situations. We want them well trained. We want them to have vacations. We want them in the best possible condition they can be to work with a very intense population. And I think going after Oregon's cost per inmate per day as a way to identify savings in the correctional system is completely misguided and will get us bad results, both for Oregon's long-term public safety system and all the individuals involved.
And we should mention here that that is one of the arguments of Clackamas County District Attorney John Foote, one of the commissioners on this commission. And he feels that Oregon's cost per inmate per day is above the national average, and that this is what the commission should have been addressing instead of changing Oregon's sentencing policies. In fact, DA Foote submitted an alternative report and recommendations to the commission. And all of these reports that we're mentioning tonight will be linked to our website, kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. So, Karen, Phoenix Rising Transitions is an organization that helps people transition back to the community after incarceration. Why are these community-based services so important, and does the commission address the need for these services?
95% of people do get out of prison eventually. So there are only 5% who are staying in on a permanent basis. And as they come out, they do need support in the community. And in Phoenix, we want to make sure that they're not just staying out of prison or leading a life of crime, but that they're becoming responsible citizens, that they're good parents, that they are workers, that they are taxpayers, that they get involved in the political process. Having really strong transition services is something that impacts the crime rate significantly. One of the things that Phoenix Rising Transitions has been involved with is founding a reentry transition center in Portland, and it's been in operation for 3 years now. It got a justice assistance grant, or the state did, that came down through the Criminal Justice Commission and funded some demonstration projects in Eugene and Klamath Falls and Portland. And they just got their first report back, and it demonstrated that for every tax dollar spent in Oregon on corrections, that there's $11 worth of savings that accompany that. So I think you can't underestimate the importance of good transition services and coordinated services. And also, it made a 30% reduction in new felony convictions. So there's a lot there to be said for strong transition services and their role in reducing the crime rate in Oregon. And I don't know the number, but there is a marked increase in people staying out of prison when they've had at least one visit in 6 months prior to their release. So I think that you cannot underestimate the importance of community members interacting with people coming out. And that is part of the evidence-based practice that we're hoping the commission, in their recommendations for that, that will turn into some legislation that will benefit a wider access to those kind of services in the community. The community needs support as well, because we take on a huge role in transition services. And it's not just left to the professionals. And in Phoenix Rising Transitions, we don't think it should just be left to the professionals. This is a community problem. The community needs to be educated about it. And there is a lot of evidence to back up this kind of community response to keeping people out of prison as one facet of keeping the crime rate down.
So does this report go far enough?
I mean, we certainly think it could have gone further. As we were just discussing, earn time, an increase for people who currently get it, is smart. We also think that it should be made applicable to, you know, people who are in for offenses that aren't eligible, especially, you know, even at the federal level, all crimes, I think, other than homicide, are eligible for a 15% earn time. It's a very small percentage, but so people would have to serve 85% of their sentence. We think it would be smart for Oregon to use that for everyone who's currently in prison, and that's currently not on the table. There were also some further reforms to the youth justice system that were around kids who get tried as adults that were considered but not put in the recommendations, that we think would be smart for Oregon, our best practices when it comes to making youth both accountable and less likely to recidivate. And we think it could have gone further, although we're certainly supportive that the commission has come up with the recommendations it has, and really identified very modest tweaks to our system to keep us from having to build new prisons over the next 10 years and spend all of that $600 million in those ways.
I would have liked to have seen prison reform come not from a place of let's find budget dollars, but come from a more holistic approach that addresses from the root causes of crime through restorative justice. I would have liked them to address the box on housing and employment applications that asks if a person has ever been convicted of a felony. You know, address some of these obstacles people face once they return to their communities after incarceration. And what about treatment for mental health? Now we have over 50%, well over 50% of people with mental health issues in our correctional system right now, and over 70% of those with addictions. Does the commission talk about drug and alcohol or mental health treatment?
Mostly in the form of recommending an expansion of the use of drug courts as their focus there. And I think this is a place where we could go further with how we change our public safety system. There is no question that the fact that, you know, back in the 70s, we deinstitutionalized the mentally ill across the country, really, and that those people are now filling our prisons and aren't getting adequate care and support to live not just crime-free lives, but lives where they can actually be successful and contributing members of our community. So I think that may be a bigger problem, this commission. And you know, with, I think, the guidance of Pew, because this is the work they've done around the country, are really looking at lowering costs. And it's not that kind of complete system overhaul that you're talking about. But I hope it will be a good start towards getting our resources in the right places and not spending so much on prison beds that we're having to cut services that matter. At my organization, when we talk about a holistic approach, one thing we always want to look at is what victims, how their services are, and needs are being met. And it was heartening that this commission did two victim roundtables where they brought victim advocates in two different parts of the state together to hear about their needs, and those needs were addressed in the report, particularly around the areas of domestic and sexual violence victims, which there's a huge need in our state to beef up those services. Last year alone, 20,000 calls for emergency services went unmet. That means someone calling and saying, I need emergency shelter for me and my kids, and the crisis line worker having to say, there is no room. You can go ride the MAX line tonight. You can go sleep under a bridge tonight to be safe, but I have no place for you to go. That's unacceptable in Oregon, and we need to do something about that. So we are thankful from that holistic perspective that that need was identified in the report. So I think there were some attempts to reach some of those areas that you're talking about that need more attention and resources. But again, yes, it's an area where we could have gone further.
How are both of your organizations, how are you going to approach this? Are you building campaigns? What are you doing?
Phoenix is a member of Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, or we call it MACG for short, and it is comprised of institutions, member institutions, and that includes churches, synagogues, labor unions, community organizations. And so one of the issues that we have taken on is to look at the Sentencing Commission, and we attended a lot of the meetings. We had some of our folks that testified at the meetings. So out of that, we are trying to develop a campaign that's based on what the recommendations finally manifest as. So we don't have anything concrete yet because we're waiting to see what kind of legislation emerges. But we have also worked with Partnership for Safety and Justice because we want to make sure that we're speaking with one voice. So we want our partnerships to be strong and consistent.
At Partnership for Safety and Justice, we have members. We hold action team meetings in Portland, Salem, and Eugene, but then also have a rural conference call for our rural members. And we will be organizing folks particularly around our lobby day, which is going to be on February 25th. If people want to sign up through our on our website to be part of our team. We will have other opportunities to visit with legislators and take other actions in support of moving a package for public safety reform forward during the 2013 session. We are calling it our Stand Strong for Safety and Savings campaign, and we do think this is sort of the best opportunities had in probably two decades to actually move some real public safety reform. So we think it's a great time to get involved and hope that some of your listeners will.
What can we do? How should we support our legislators?
Well, the first thing you need to know is who are your legislators? So get online and find out or make a phone call. Who is your state senator? Who is your House representative? I would encourage you, if you're interested, to sign up on our Safety and Justice website.
And Shannon, give that website?
It's www.safetyandjustice.org. And that's just all written out, A-N-D, safetyandjustice.org.
And your legislators need your support. They have been fearful of appearing soft on crime. And Governor Kitzhaber challenged our Oregon legislatures, saying that it costs $10,000 a year to keep a child in school, but it costs $30,000 a year to keep someone in prison. And the governor said, if our legislators are unwilling to act on this issue, we will by default be choosing prisons over schools.
I think it's really important not only that we talk to our legislators, but we need to make sure there is a concerted effort to educate the public about the issues of crime and incarceration. There's a sense for a lot of Oregonians that our crime rate is up. That's not the case. So I think that there's a need for strong education of the public. And if we're going to support our legislators, then we need to make sure that we understand the issues and what is clearly a fact and what is actually rhetoric.
So I want to thank my guest, Shannon White from Partnership for Safety and Justice, and Karen Muir from Phoenix Rising Transitions, for doing just that. explaining and providing an understanding of these issues.
Thank you for having us, Karen.
Thank you.
You have been listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Again, thank you to my guests. Thank you to our engineer, AJ. Good night.
It's 7:01 p.m. and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in Wednesday, February 6th at 6 p.m. for Treasures from the KBOO Vault. We are celebrating our 45th anniversary by looking at our past and sharing precious recordings with you. This month, we'll listen to an interview with Art Dilworth, recorded in 1977 by KBOO's own George Page. We'll also hear a speech recorded in 1992 by Dick Gregory. Again, that's February the 6th at 6 p.m. here at KBOO Portland, your community radio station for 45 years.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Portland premiere of Who Bombed Judy Berry at the Clinton Street Theater, Wednesday, February 13th. The film will play at both 7 p.m. and 9:15. This new documentary covers the 1990 bomb attack on two Northern California environmental activists, which still remains unsolved. The film is a compelling tribute to Berry, a fiery speaker whose background as a union organizer put her in a unique position to bridge the cultural divide between forest activists and rank-and-file loggers.
I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe.
Again, that's Wednesday, February 13th at the Clinton Street Theater. More information may be found at kboo.fm/Berry2013.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, Democracy Now! Is at 7 a.m., followed by Abe and Joe, who will be speaking with Oregon state legislatures who are working to limit the use of drones